Good afternoon. So, my process for today is that I'm going to take your things you'd like me to talk about. I'm going to collect the list of them. I'm going to go through that list. If we have time after that, I'll collect another list. If there's no more questions, I'll just pack up and leave. So, what things would you like me to talk about? Yeah.
Exam format.
Exam format, okay. Other things? Anything else? Yes. Okay, relocation table, okay. Quiz week 15, okay, which I probably should have looked at beforehand. Okay. Oh, I see. I keyed something wrong in the week 15 quiz. Okay. We can go over that. Okay. Yeah.
The different, the dot pointed value bounds after same times are just when would you use one versus the other? Slash,
pros and cons. And so, okay. Pointer, subterfuge, okay. Anything else we'd like to talk about? Yeah, okay. What was the beginning? Okay. This is an exam. Yeah, okay. Anything. Yeah.
Question 10 on the 27th.
Okay, which is about. What's the topic of that question? No idea? Okay. Usually would like to know what the topic is of a question. Question 10. Ah, malware placement. Okay, so that's on virus code insertion, I would say. This probably goes with polymorphic malware. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Anything else? Okay, so let's get started. So exam format, probably kind of similar to what's in 2017, maybe a few fewer open-ended questions. As for rest on the exam, we expect you to know about sort of the kind of ownership and borrowing ideas. We don't care about syntax. And I guess we expect you to understand sort of the idea of ref counting. We don't care about syntax. Sort of most similar to 2017 final, probably you open-ended questions just because of grading time. You don't want to read a lot of stuff to grade it. And you'll have 3 hours. I hope to have an exam which is shorter than that by a lot. But I am always bad at guessing how long people will take, so who knows. Also, I know some people, if I gave them a one-page exam and gave them 8 hours, they would take 8 hours. There's some people like that, so. But not my goal for that to happen. Okay, so relocation tables. So when we're producing, when we're doing dynamic linking or static linking, we have sort of some file with kind of missing references to other files. So the setup, so example is an executable with references to a library it loads, or an object file with references to other object files. And the linker needs to fill in these references. This is when the program is loaded for dynamic linking, and when the program is created otherwise. So with non-dynamic linking, there's some of it happens at when we create the program, and some of it happens later, depending on what the reference is to. If the reference is to another object file, all of it happens with the create. The relocation table lists what the linker needs to fill in. So it has, so each entry contains sort of where is the hole to fill in, what format does that hole have. So example, is it a global offset table entry, which needs to be a pointer? Is it the offset in a jump instruction, which needs to be a number of bytes between this jump and the place to jump to? So we need that foreground information, and what symbol the hole should refer to. So this is typically, example, foo for the function. And the linker will match the relocation table up against with a symbol table to figure out how to fill holes. And the symbol table entries have sort of symbol name and location in some file. Questions, things I didn't talk about with relocation tables, you want to go over? Okay. So then we get to here, have questions on kind of virus stuff. So Q10 on this exam was saying that suppose a virus searches for the machine code for retnop EAX not vowel EAX EAX1, where you're told that this is a 8-byte no-op instruction. And it replaces this machine code with a jump to virus code. And the question was, what could go wrong here? And we had some options. So one was we could fail a stack canary check. And the answer for this is no, because the stack canary check must have been before the ret in the original code. And we must have popped, and we must have popped the stack canary off the stack for the ret to work. So the stack canary is no longer a factor at this point. Second option was these bytes could have been in another instruction. And this is a concern because we could have, for example, had a move, you know, that contains like something with this looks like a ret. And we could have had kind of the exact right setup where it ends up looking like the middle of this move instruction is the start of this sequence. And we get confused. Or sort of string constant in program would be another thing that could confuse us. Like a string could contain any bytes, like maybe the string representing like an image file or something like that. So that is a concern. Inserted jump in non-executable region. This could happen, but wouldn't cause a crash, because we never run those bytes. I guess this could happen, but wouldn't, would only cause a crash if the non-executable region was data or similar that needed to be correct. This would have to be another example of confusing sort of machine code, these bytes with something else. And then the part of this question, jump to the virus code, and the jump is composed of the opcode for jump plus the offset of virus code minus offset of this code. And this would, you know, wrong offset when jump in different segments. This could happen depending if the load directive has a, you know, p-adder address field that, you know, I guess if we have load addresses, like we have load, sort of the normal segment load, it's like load from offset to adder like 4000, and then we have the virus code in something with like offset loads to like this. If we have something like this, then, you know, code at offset, or like, you know, 9100 in the file, won't be know, say, 8,000 bytes away from 1.0 when the program runs, and this would make the jump not work. Yeah?
So why does C not work again? Because we're inputting a jump code for the virus, and then we're jumping to that code, and I'm assuming we're going to execute that code, right?
Why does C not work?
Yeah.
You mean the insert a jump in non-executable region? So if we did this, we could break the executable by editing data that's important. And because it's not executable, we definitely won't actually run the jump.
Maybe I just misread the question.
It's possible the key is wrong. Also, but what I would say is, like, this could crash the program because whatever data we replace there could do something. And if it's not executable, it's probably not actually running. Right? It's probably we got confused about what that data was.
So just to clarify, this would crash the program.
This could crash the program? It could crash the program. I think probably the question was, this is a borderline case, we probably should have dropped that option. Because it's like, how likely is it to crash the program it's not clear.
So in what case would it not crash?
So let's say the data that we modified just represented like strings, right? It would just make the string weird,
okay.
Right?
Okay.
And that's probably the most likely case. But it's not certainly, we can imagine a circumstance where we're modifying something that could crash the program. Does that answer your question? Other questions? But I guess from the context, we definitely know that's not actually a return. Because it's not going to run. Okay, so then asking about polymorphic malware. So I guess we talked about kind of, these categories of sort of two strategies malware use to have kind of different machine code each time. And kind of the typical polymorphic strategy was to have a kind of code generator template, sort of have an encryptor generator template that had sort of several versions and sort of a randomly encrypted part. And then we also have this typical, what was called metamorphic strategy, which had a machine code translator, which sort of would have some table of how to change instructions and would be applied to itself. So those are kind of two sort of pretty sophisticated strategies we talked about. And sort of for detection, so the polymorphic strategy, kind of the simplest thing to do, sort of simplest idea is to write a pattern to match the decryptor. I should say probably not an encryptor template, but a decryptor to match all possible decryptors, which we can typically do because it's kind of this template with fill in the blanks. We can typically write kind of a regular expression type pattern that matches that relatively efficiently. For the metamorphic strategy, can still write a detector, but might need something, sort of more hand-spun than just a regex, depending on how those changes work. And depending on the details of what the manipulations are, but people have made things that try to look for those pieces. Yeah.
Just speaking like that detection strategy for
question, which characterizes you from metamorphic structure analysis. So what I should describe is like a hand-built state machine. So you just say, I know that this has does this, then this, then this. I'm going to look for the machine code that does this, then the machine code that does this, then the machine code that does this. This is presumably what they're doing. And they just have something which like handles, it could be transformed in all these different ways, but we'll just detect that. You know, one of the ways it could be transformed into, followed by another, and, you know, it's not going to appear by accident. It's the idea. I guess the other, or we can do behavior-based detection, right? You don't have to actually look for statically. You can just see how it runs. You know, and that kind of gets around all these encryption, decryption, code obfuscation problems. And you can do heuristic stuff, like for encryption stuff, you can do, you know, heuristically look for encrypted data with kind of entropy analysis, but what you do at a false positive. I don't think we talked about that, but that's probably worth mentioning, especially since Cathedra has a button that does it. But is that you can like look at how I think you can know is that machine code typically has a certain distribution of what bytes appear, and the encryptor strategy that makes that wrong. And that's usually something that, you know, can tell, but of course it's going to have lots of false positives, so how useful it is. But the behavior-based detection is definitely a very common strategy, and, you know, you need to have a completely different set of tactics to fool that. Some questions on our polymorphic, et cetera, malware? Okay. So, pointer subterfuge. So, this is sort of, the idea is we have some way of changing pointer's value, then having the program use the pointer. And kind of the most common form is like we have a buffer and a pointer, and we can, so example, if we overflow buffer, then we can change where pointer points. Then if the program does something like we can write to wherever we want in memory. So that this pattern, you know, comes up a bunch. That's why we mentioned it. And this is kind of less direct than our kind of classic stack buffer overflow or overflowing even a vtable pointer, because this typically doesn't directly give us code execution. So sort of challenge, not immediately obvious, how to turn this into code execution, because the pointer doesn't, you know, because we don't use pointer to execute anything, right? It's not like a return address where we're using it to execute something, or a vtable pointer. We're using it to find the code to run. So the sort of typical solution is we look for a pointer, I guess something writable that is used to execute code. You know, if we had writable executable memory, so if we could overwrite a normal function, that would work. But typically, you know, that would just segfault, because that memory is just segfault, because that memory is read-only. Not guaranteed, but that's usually how programs are built. If you look at the obfuscate assignment, the decryptor of the obfuscate program had writable executable memory, but that's not a typical program we see. So we can look for if we know where a return address that will be used is, we can replace, make it point somewhere else. If we know where a vtable pointer or vtable is, or a writable vtable entry is, we can make it else. And there's different levels of indirection here, right? So here, point somewhere else, and here would be to our code to run. And here, it would be to a pointer to a fake vtable pointing to our code to run for the vtable pointer, because that's what the pointer expects. If we know where a writable global offset table entry is, writable equals no relocation read only use, we can make it point somewhere else. And these will run at different points in time, right? So here, point somewhere else, and this runs our code when that function returns. Function call returns, I should say. Runs our code when we make a polymorphic method call on that object. And here we have it runs our code when we call the library function that uses that got entry defined. Uses that got entry. I guess whose stub uses that got entry to find where the library app is loaded this time in memory. And you know, we might have some other options. So that's typically what we do in this case. So alternately, we could just mess up the program's data. You know, so like set the, you know, past, the grade variable to A, you know, that sort of thing, if we know where it is. Yeah.
So in the case of the vtable, am I understanding correctly that you would just set, like the input is just the address of the fake vtable, and then that location is where you would have like your malicious code?
So in the case of the vtable, right, our typical way that if we have an object, right, is that we have a vtable pointer. You know, so let's say this is rectangle, right? We have a vtable pointer, we have the sort of width and height, let's say. And this vtable pointer is going to point to, and when things are normal, to the rectangle to some state memory containing the area method, and the, and any other methods we have, right? So area and print, let's say, and, some more methods. When we replace, so sort of before overwriting, and if we overwrite the vtable here, so this would be after overwriting table pointer, we'll change where this vtable pointer points, and we'll make it, we still have that original table of pointer somewhere in memory, but we'll make it point to sort of our area, a pointer to all these stuff, and this will point to our code, right? because I guess I would mention in the original VTable, just to make this clear, this is the real, the normal area, rectangle area, right? These are pointers. Right, so that's what we're gonna do. We're gonna replace it with a pointer to a new table, so we have to store that somewhere. Most common, if we have a buffer and know where the buffer is, we can just have part of what we input be that new table. Or, you know, if we like inputted something in the program earlier and know where it's stored, we can just point to that. But we set that scenario up. So we're gonna need, so because the data structure uses indirection, we have to duplicate that indirection. Does that answer your question? And conceptually, we could instead imagine replacing, you know, this pointer, but in many programs, that's going to be read-only memory. Because of, we mentioned relocation read-only, that typically after it's initialized, kind of modern systems will be set up to mark that as read-only, just so we can't do that. Does that answer your question? Other follow-ups on pointer subterfuge stuff? Okay, so the fat pointers, baggy bounds, and so these are all sort of ways of adding bounds checking. And from a design goals point of view, we have kind of two ideas. So one is sort of, you know, preventing security flaws, and the other is sort of reliably sort of finding memory bugs. And baggy bounds is firmly in the preventing security flaws from happening point of view. An address sanitizer is firmly in the finding memory bugs. And fat pointers is probably in between. It kind of does, you know, doesn't make compromises for one end or the other, but baggy bounds and address sanitizer clearly make compromises on both of these factors. And sort of the strategy used is we have kind of two methods. So we have kind of track where objects are and figure out, we go out of bounds of them, and that's what fat pointers and baggy bounds use. And we have this alternate strategy of track what memory is valid, or is valid, and figure out when invalid memory is accessed, and add sort of empty spaces to make most out of bounds, usually hidden valid memory. And this is the strategy address sanitizer uses. So address sanitizer like doesn't actually track where objects are. It just tracks, you know, where invalid memory is and tries to have there be invalid memory in around things that we could go around. And kind of the implementation idea is for fat pointers, you know, for every pointer, track the sort of object it points to, sort of, which is, it points to is, you know, what did we originally, you know, so for example, is if we have at foo.bar, 5, the original object is foo.bar. If we have bar4.x, the original object foo.bar for x. All right, we just track. What did this originally point to? And when pointer is used, when pointer, you know, after pointer arithmetic and before dereferencing, make sure the pointer still points to the same object. So this means can access other things in an array using indexing or pointer arithmetic. You know, can't sort of skip from one object in the array to another, or similar. And kind of a challenge here, and this kind of needs, a challenge here is that we need to track the information along with the pointer because we can't look at it. So then we have baggy bounds, and the idea here is that we don't track any sort of extra information with pointers, but have a way to look up what object a pointer points to. And this means that given at foo bar, we'll know it points to foo, but can't be more specific. So unlike baggy bounds, because we have to have this lookup table, all these things have to like look up to the same object. We're not going to be more specific about sort of what the pointer bounds actually are, and like the fat pointer strategy, because we have to have a global lookup table that tells us this pointer points to x. And whenever we do pointer arithmetic, make sure we don't jump from one top level object to another. Right. And it's only top-level objects because, again, we have this big lookup table, so we can't, like, track parts of objects separately. And to make this lookup fast, we sort of round object sizes to a power of 2, so our lookup table can be relatively compact. And this means that we, can skip from one object in an array to another, but can't skip between top-level objects. And it also means that we won't reliably detect sort of off-by-one issues because they might be maybe in kind of rounded object size. Whereas the fat pointer idea can reliably detect those because we can choose to store the exact bounds, we're spending the time to do that. An address sanitizer, again, is tracking, we don't track any extra information with pointers. But have a way not to look up the object something belongs to look up whether a byte of memory is valid. Insert invalid bytes between sort of objects in the heap or the stack. And this would be kind of top level objects. Whenever we dereference a pointer, make sure it's in it. It's only using valid bytes of memory. And this means that we can skip between objects as long as we don't land in between. So this doesn't prevent certain types of kind of buffer overflows. It prevents buffer overflows where we have to cover every byte, but we can skip around. Or we're going to cut a pointer subterfuge bug. It's not going to find that. But it will reliably detect off by one issues because we can make sure we have an invalid byte when after an object. Yeah.
That one quiz question we had an array of objects. The address sanitizer will only detect something's wrong if it's outside of the total array of objects?
Yes, and that's because we have to insert invalid bytes, and we can't just insert that in the middle of an array.
Okay.
Right, because of the way arrays work. So I guess I'll mention sort of not in the middle of objects because this would break other sort of non-address sanitizer code that expects those objects not to have gaps. And that's the problem with an array is if you're calling memcopy, it expects the array not to have gaps. And address sanitizer, has made a decision they don't want to break other code that's using the object, so they don't change the object layout. Other questions? Yes? Okay. Okay, smart pointer types in Rust. So in Rust, we have kind of our normal references sort of enforce the rule that we have sort of compile time determined, single writer, or a single modifier, because read and write, or sort of multiple readers. Right, that's how normal references in Rust work. And you can't delete things that are, and sort of freeing object requires sort of modifier access. So you can't have something go out of scope unless you have kind of exclusive access to it. Then we have kind of various rule, and I guess we have another kind of rule that is built into the compiler. We had kind of cells, which were so marked as immutable, sort of treated like immutable, like read-only. Read-only, but allows modifications by replacing the value all at once. And this is kind of built into the compiler, even though it looks like a smart pointer, but it has this property that we allow modification, even if there are other readers. But the reason that's safe is that we're replacing the whole thing. So, can modify while other readers will see old value or new value, and can't take references to inside of a cell. So these are kind of, then we have kind of these smart pointer type, then we have the smart pointers, which are sort of do runtime tracking to ensure safety. And we talked about a few of them, not all of them. So one of the simplest was RC. So this is reference counting. So allow multiple readers and keep the object alive until there are no readers, which is unlike normal references where we can only stay valid as long as being borrowed from somewhere keeps the memory valid. Right. So with normal references, we have to say this comes from somewhere, which is keeping this memory around. RCE lets us relax that rule by keeping the memory around until no one's using it. I guess I would say still valid as long as, I guess there's two options, as long as borrowed from somewhere if reference, or is the original copy. Is the main copy, I should say. Main copy. It was moved in. Not a reference. Right. We have the non-reference version of the object. With RC, we don't have that restriction anymore. So it just keeps the object around until there are no readers without us having to have kind of an original copy to keep it alive. And this does not allow writers in Rust. It just says it's a read-only thing. We also talked about RefSal, which is kind of dynamic, sort of interior mutability. So this allows sort of modifiers. You know, make sure there's modifiers and readers. There's only one. Make sure that if there's a modifier, there are no readers, and does this by counting the number of readers at a time. And sort of appears as read-only thing, so you can put it in an RC. The readers, and this again does this by counting the number of readers in the same readers plus modifiers. So both of these work by counting at runtime, which means that they're going to do that bookkeeping. You have to store the number somewhere, and we have to update it as things do start and stop using this object. And there's some other smart pointer types in Rust, other most notable ones are for threading, which we didn't talk about because CSO2 is not a prereq, but kind of the things you saw for synchronization CSO2 have some smart pointer version. Okay, and week 15 quiz. I think I keyed one of the questions incorrectly. I will fix that. So question 2-4C is keyed incorrectly. 2-4C is wrong, has wrong key. Sorry about that. So then the other thing, question 1B was saying that we could instead cause that if we could change where a call goes, change a call that like does something like global offset table lookup, we could make it go somewhere. And could we run a function that runs the message as a shell command? We saw a function called system that does that. So question Q1B, sort of the step library function system runs its argument as a shell command, seems like a good candidate that will have an NBR64 in it already. So that would be why that's likely to be possible, and that's part of the standard library, which is probably loaded with our program. Yeah, question. Right, it's just part of libc.so. So we just need to figure out where it is loaded, and we can probably make that happen. Okay. I think that's the only... To be. So for 2B, it would not be likely not be possible because Clang would have a list of what are the valid function pointers that based on that I've seen assigned to this anywhere in the code. And presumably there would be no code anywhere that ever assigned the system function to there.
Okay.
So it wouldn't be on that list.
Okay.
So Q2B, Clang has a bit mask of allowed functions determined by seeing what could have been assigned to the function pointer by any code it saw. And there just isn't going to be any code that it saw that would ever have put system there under any possible set of if statements or whatever. Okay, so that's we're all
theoretically, if our program did call system, like if that was like a function now.
So if our program called system, so Clang is going to do this analysis kind of on a function pointer by function pointer basis,
yeah.
Right? It's going to say, let me look at all the things that are going to get assigned to this pointer. So for this to be a problem, we'd have to have some reason that analysis would get confused and think the system function could end up there. So if the code program never uses system, it's pretty trivial to say it won't get confused. The program does use system, then the question is the analysis going to be precise enough to figure out what can go into that pointer and what can't? And that probably depends on the details of how this process works. Right, because the big thing you mentioned is that Clang's going to do these approximations where it says, oh, there's an if statement here. I have to think that the if statement could have any value, right? And therefore, it might look at some impossible code paths for that reason. I think probably it's not super likely that one of those would work this way, but I could imagine, you know, ways that could happen. Okay, so that's, yes, question? Question 5C in the quiz. So question is, why won't it prevent them from submitting a form? So submitting a form is not an operation which requires reading cookies yourself. It's whenever the browser sends something, it sends the cookies. Assuming it's a first party request, you know, assuming it's not doing privacy stuff. This is not a case. This is, looks like to the browser, oh, you have a form on the website and the user must have asked to submit it. Is what it looks like to the user, to the browser. And when the browser submits stuff to that website, it sends the cookies. So even though the JavaScript code won't see the cookie, it will still be sent with the form. Does that answer your question? Okay, and I'm more than out of time. I have office hours later today, and also on Wednesday, and also on Friday, which I will hopefully be able to keep all of, even though I'm giving other exams. So, see you next week.
Thank you.